Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air, listener-supported community radio station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois, at 90.1 FM, and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.central.org. centraliljwj.org. That's centraliljwj.org. And also programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour, and the World Labor Hour is happy that Bill renewed his underwriting, his community partnership here for another year. And the AFL-CIO of Champaign County also just renewed their community partnership with WEFT and the Illinois World Labor Hour. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob. Yeah, we got a special guest in the studio today. Kevin Farrelly's a member of the Champaign Federation of Teachers. He's a school psychologist. We're going to be talking about psychopathic behavior in corporate CEOs and certain politicians. So this is a little interesting topic for us, but, you know, that's the thing is that we here at the World Labor Hour feel that, you know, any issue that affects working people in some way, directly or indirectly, is fair game for us. And so anyway, he'll be coming in shortly here, but we're going to first start off with some news of various types. So I guess I'll start with Gus. Gus, what's been happening?
Well, we got some people turning to the streets now, doing some very collective actions. I'm excited to see this happening in regards to police brutality. The Black Lives Matter movement took to the streets in the Bay Area, protesting the February 3rd killing of Yvette Henderson by police. There was a march organized by the Anti-Police Terror Project, proceeded from the Emeryville Police Station, the rally organized by Onyx Organizing Committee, Asians for Black Lives, and Blackout Collective, where activists blockade all entrances to the Emeryville Home Depot. So they close all the entrances to the Home Depot down for 5 hours, which is the period of time that Yvette's body, the young woman who was killed by the police, Yvette Henderson, that 5 hours that her body was left to lie in the street after she was shot and killed. She's a 38-year-old Black woman and mother of two who was killed by police after allegedly shoplifting at the Home Depot. Multiple eyewitnesses to her death said that she was unarmed, and one particular protester said that Yvette was desperately trying to wave down cars and a bus to get out of the situation. So she was actually trying to escape for her life when she saw the police had their guns drawn on her for a nonviolent accusation of shoplifting. So what I'm really excited to see is that we are having different groups of different diversities coming together and actually protesting these things in the street, because we're putting pressure on the politicians, we're putting pressure on the preachers, we're putting pressure on all these other groups to actually start saying something and making a condemnation against police brutality, which is really going to lead to a change in how the whole structure is maintained. So I'm excited about that.
This is just incredible. I mean, boy, I'll tell you what, you know, I don't even remember things like this happening back when I was a kid during the 60s when things were going on. I mean, this level of police violence against unarmed people for either petty offenses, nonviolent petty offenses, or no offenses whatsoever. I mean, this is just reaching epidemic, you know, horrible proportions. And it's just, God, every time I hear one of these stories, it just makes my gut wrench and my heart ache. I mean, it's just like, God, how, you know, and it makes me angry. I mean, that's the thing. This is like, you know, first the heart wrench and then the anger.
Well, you know what the data says. The data says that in relation to the nadir period, which is the lowest point for African Americans when the lynching was going on between 1890 and 1930, we're talking about, what was it? Today it is 30. What is it? Every 28 hours an African American is killed by police. Whereas in there, during the nadir period, it actually was a little bit over a day plus a few, like, I think it was like 35 hours an African American. So actually the time has been condensed so that more African Americans are being killed now in relation to state-sponsored or private violence. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so we're looking at nadir-like numbers. But you know, I mean, but the good thing, like I said, the best part about this is that there is resistance and there is a response by different groups to put pressure on these people to actually do something about it.
Where is Emeryville?
Emeryville is right by San Francisco, so it's out in the Bay Area.
Okay, all right.
So
okay.
California's trying to join the fight, and we still have the incidents going on in Madison right now. Protests are still going on in Madison right now. So yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot of fervor around the country.
Yeah, I like that name of that organization. What is it? Organization Against Police Terror.
Yeah, Anti-Police Terror Project.
They are
extremely active right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Bob, what's new with you? What do you have for us today?
Well, I'm going to talk about my buddy Bruce Rauner again.
Oh, Bruce Rauner and Rahm Emanuel. What a pair.
Well, actually, the Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, dealt a blow to Governor Bruce Rauner's controversial push to create local zones where union rules don't apply. This is in a 15-page opinion requested by two Democratic lawmakers. The Attorney General said federal labor statutes preclude local governments from declaring themselves as so-called right-to-work zones. Here's a quote from Lisa Madigan here. It says, "It is my opinion that the National Labor Relations Act preempts counties and municipalities from adopting local ordinances that regulate the use of union security agreements," the opinion noted. Here's State Senator Gary Formby from Benton, Illinois, said the decision signals that union busting laws are an issue for the General Assembly, not local governments. I guess that's that. The Attorney General's opinion makes it pretty clear this is a matter for state lawmakers, and the Southern Illinois lawmakers I know on both sides of the aisle aren't going to hurt working families, Forby said in a prepared statement. Maybe now the governor can start focusing on putting people back to work in Southern Illinois. People around here just want jobs where they'll be respected with an honest wage for an honest day's work. This is the Attorney General's opinion as a second labor-related missive that Madigan has issued in response to the moves by the new governor. Earlier, she sided with labor groups in a fight with Rauner over an executive order that said requiring government workers to pay union fees is a violation of the First Amendment. Madigan declared that order constitutional. A response from Rauner's office says the Rauner administration respectfully disagrees with the Attorney General's opinion regarding local right to work. The administration is confident that with enabling legislation from state, local governments can create employee empowerment zones. So we'll see how that plays out, but definitely Lisa Madigan came down on the side of the workers and mm-hmm. the unions and stuff and said Rauner doesn't have the ability to do this. Also happening here just the day before on Thursday, this just happened on Friday, Illinois governor orders agencies to divert fair share fees away from unions. It says Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner dogged in attempts to eliminate fees paid to unions by workers who choose not to join, has instructed state agencies to divert money from non-union employee paychecks away from organized labor until a judge settles the matter. Listen to this. It says, in a memo obtained by the Associated Press, General Counsel Jason Barkley directs departments under the Republican governors to control to create two sets of books, one of which would move deductions from non-union members to the operations budget of state agencies instead of to unions, although the money would not be spent. So evidently, he's advocating creating two sets of books for these people and keeping some of this stuff off the record, so to speak, you know. So Rauner is a piece of cake there, you know. So.
This is going to be a seesaw back and forth for the next 4 years. I mean,
it is.
It's just he's not going to be able to get anything done. I mean, but the thing is, there is things he can do. Like I heard from an anonymous source who has a somebody they know very well who's an administrator at the University of Illinois, and I heard that they've already gotten orders to start cutting back departments and also. So there's things he can do, well, and the legislature is going to have to, you know, constantly play, you know, catch up and, you know, plug the holes in the dam, so to speak.
Mentioned last week, I think, about Rauner stopping some of the construction projects at state parks and
yep.
city parks and things like that, so he's going to keep fighting. Fortunately, maybe, unlike Wisconsin, where Walker was able to kind of push a lot of things through the legislature up there. We still have a fairly strongly Democratic legislature here in the state, and so Rauner's going to be butting heads with them for 4 years, and with Lisa Madigan, and with a number of other people.
That is the difference, right, at this point, is between Illinois and Wisconsin, or Michigan, is that there the Republican right wing governors had you know, the majority in at least one house, if not both. You know, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about our mutual friend the other day, who is a retired tradesman, and who said he actually kind of liked Rauner. Well, I understand that Rauner is going to be cutting back on stocking ponds in state parks, and that they're going to be raising fees on hunting licenses and closing certain facilities. So I'm thinking, I'm hoping this is going to, he's going to basically be stepping on his, you know what, the more bolder he tries to get. We can only hope, but on the other hand, we can't just sit back and give him enough rope to hang himself, because sometimes that strategy comes back and, you know, bite you, so to speak, you know. It'll be interesting.
It will be. At least Lisa Madigan comes out and says, you know, he can't do it for now. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yes.
You
know? Okay. Negotiations for free trade deals between the U.S., Europe, and the Pacific continue to proceed in secrecy with a blackout by the corporate media. While awesomely branded as trade negotiations, whose aim is to increase trade by abolishing tariffs, these deals are essentially power grabs by multinational corporations to remove regulatory barriers on their profits. Of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, 29 draft chapters, only 5 deal with traditional trade issues. The majority would strip governments, both national, state, and local, from having their current power on worker and workers and citizens of health and safety regulations, environmental protections, food safety rules, and other policies benefiting the public. Because of this blackout, the public and Congress itself is prevented from knowing the details of these talks. Congress itself is prevented from knowing the details of these talks. I want to repeat that. Public Citizens Global Trade Watch reports that it is only through leaks of the actual negotiations that much information on these deals has been made public. However, over 600 corporate quote-unquote trade advisors have full access to the text. Both trade deals reveal the utter collapse of democracy in the U.S. and the complete subservience of both major parties to the whim of corporate special interests. And anyway, it says proposals including these Frankenstein-like deals roll back the minimum banking regulations enacted to protect consumers. Any governmental financial regulation would be subordinated to the extreme version of a deregulated system. Containing the proposals, a tax on financial transactions would not be permitted. In healthcare, exemptions for big pharmaceutical companies to extend patents for 8 to 12 years and perhaps even longer would raise prices and restrict access to many needed drugs, not to mention probably provisions to prevent any kind of single-payer healthcare system. And it goes on and on. And, I mean, basically what this is it's an effort. And, you know, I don't use this term, you know, loosely. Is that this is a bill that's going to create a system of corporate feudalism. I mean, it's really frightening what's in here. And I mean, I'm letting everyone know about this is because this is coming up, and they're going to be trying to really go full court press on trying to convince the public this is going to create jobs, etc. It's not, and it's just going to be very harmful. So, you know, I urge you to call your U.S. House congressman and both senators and tell them to stop, you know, do not vote for this. So anyway, we'll have you more up details on this as things come along. So anyway, you're listening to World Labor Hour. We're going to take a quick music break, and then we'll be right back with our guest, and we are going to open the phone lines for the listeners to call in with any questions or comments. So stay tuned.
I was traveling through Illinois when I was invited to stop and sing at a memorial there in the little town of Mount Olive. Now, who of note in American history is buried in the cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois? I'll give you a hint. It was a woman. It was the Union Miners Cemetery. Do you have it yet? Mary Harris. Mary Harris Jones. Mother Jones. It's hard for the mind to encompass a life that embraced the presidencies between Andrew Jackson and Herbert Hoover. Why, when Mother Jones was a little girl, there were people still alive who remembered the Revolutionary War. And she died on the eve of the New Deal. Her millinery shop burned down in the Chicago fire, and she had heard Abraham Lincoln speak in person. Mostly, though, Mother Jones was the miner's friend. Down in Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia. Well, the men would be organizing the underground workers, the miners, Mother Jones had already organized their wives and led them over the snow-covered game trails down into the hollows, where, armed with mops and brooms, they drove the scabs out of the coal pits. Now, Mother Jones wasn't an organizer, she was an agitator, which meant often enough she was hated as much by the organizers as by the bosses. One time, Mother Jones was out in Colorado at the great Ludlow strike. Now, that was the strike to enforce the 8-hour day, which the state of Colorado had made a law, but they couldn't enforce it because Rockefeller owned the militia. Now, the governor promised not to send the militia into the coal fields, but he lied, and he did. Mother Jones was in the Union Hall down there at Ludlow, and word came that the militia had entered the coal fields. Well, she leapt up, and she screamed, "Let's go get the sons of bitches!" And she stormed out. She didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She just flounced up the road.
Okay, that was Utah Phillips doing a song about Mother Jones and the most dangerous woman. And looks like somebody's calling in already, kind of beating us to the punch here. You want to call back, caller? Okay, thank you. Okay, so I'd like to introduce our guest at this point. I'd like to introduce Kevin Farrell. He's a member of the Champaign Federation of Teachers. He's a school psychologist. He was on the program about a month and a half, 2 months ago with the president of Champaign Federation of Teachers, Kathy Mannon. And after the program, my co-host Bill Gorell and him were talking about, I mean, somehow it came up in the conversation about corporate CEOs and certain politicians about having psychopathic tendencies. So this kind of led to an idea, hey, let's do a whole program on this. So, Kevin, welcome back to the World Labor Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. I'd like to start out by, I think that there's a confusion in these two terms a lot of times, and I would like you to maybe try to clarify that, and that's the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath.
Sure, yeah, and then those are terms that you'll hear people use interchangeably, and I think one important thing to point out right away is that even within the psychiatric community and the medical community at large, there's debate about whether these are legitimate psychiatric conditions and whether they've been included in, you know, the diagnostic manual for these things. You know, those are dynamics that are being researched and argued back and forth at times. So the, you know, kind of definition of a psychopath, the working definition is it's a personality disorder that's really characterized by a severe, they're basically incapable of empathy, remorse. They have very shallow affect, which means they're very flat. They're not going to have a wide range of emotions, even in extreme situations like most people would. They have a lot of very superficial charm. They're able to charm a room or people. There's a level of callousness there. Basically, they're in things for themselves, and they're basically without conscience is the going thought. So a sociopath is a different situation, and they may have very well-developed consciences, and they have the capacity for empathy and guilt, and loyalty to others, but their sense of right and wrong is gonna be, their problem comes in more where their sense of right and wrong is skewed based on the kind of group or subculture that's around them. So that's
basically, for instance, the laws, perhaps.
Sure.
The legal system.
Yeah, it could be the legal system. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, one of the.
So Gandhi could be a sociopath, or Dr. Martin Luther King, in some definitions here.
Sure. Yeah, but you know, they had a positive message, right?
Oh, okay.
You know, yeah, they had a positive message.
Okay.
There.
That's good to know. I like the positive instead of negative. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the classic situations that people think of when they think of a sociopath would be, you know, some of the things that went on around Nazi Germany, mm-hmm. and normal, quote unquote, normal people engaging in horrific types of acts,
oh, okay.
Right?
Okay.
By the undue influence of the structure, political system around him, which would be
okay. Okay, so this sociopathic definition is a little more. It seems a little bit more complex than mm-hmm. this. Psychopath seems pretty straightforward, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty straightforward. They're in it for themselves, and they are incapable of remorse and guilt,
mm-hmm.
And they can turn out to be very scary people. You know, in the most recent version of what's called the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual, 5th edition, you'll hear me refer to it as the DSM-5 from here on out.
Okay.
Has never included psychopathy in its text. People have always argued that it kind of falls under what's called an antisocial personality disorder, and there's probably some features of narcissism or narcissistic disorder in there. But the most recent edition, which came out in the last year or two here, actually has now antisocial personality disorder, and you can specify what are called psychopathic features. So
okay.
That is a recent change in the American Psychiatric Association's view of that proposed diagnosis. It's something that's that has been up for debate for a long time.
Okay. Yep. So you wanted to specifically talk about some new recognized phenomena about these sort of psychopathic traits in certain people in the corporate world, in the upper echelons of the corporate world, as well as certain politicians.
Sure.
How did this kind of how did this discovery happen, so to speak?
I mean, the discovery for me or the discovery for the researchers at large?
Yeah, let's start with the researchers at large.
There are several people out there in the psychiatric community who engage in research, and one of the big ones is a guy named Bob Hare, who is a Canadian psychologist. He's famous for creating an assessment called the Psychopath Checklist Revised. It's the edition that it's currently in. It's also known as the PCLR. And it's used a lot in the prison population to determine who is basically a potential psychopath.
Okay.
And which they use to dictate and decide, you know, is this a person that's most likely to for recidivism and to be back? They'll use that information in parole hearing boards at times.
Okay.
If someone's shown a frequent pattern, a persistent pattern of engaging in these behaviors, high criminal conduct without remorse,
And that makes
something that the review board considers, and so this guy is out there, and he's a well-known person in this field, and at times he can also be a there's a debate about him and his theories, and people feel pretty strongly on both sides of it. But so I the way I came across this information is I was reading, found out about a book, and it was one that I would really recommend to anyone who's interested in this topic. It's a fascinating book that goes all over the place, but at the core of it, the author's interest is in the idea of psychopathy in corporate America and political America. And the book is called The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. And the author's name is John Ronson. And, how he got interested in it is a interesting part of the book that I won't go into, but he starts to have this idea as he's thinking about what this Bob Hare and these other people in this field are talking about. And he says, I think he has this idea that this probably exists in, some pretty horrible political situations around the world. And in some of the upper corporate America things, he's a kind of an investigative journalist, author kind of guy. The big thing, he's the author of The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Interesting film.
People. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. So he, he has this kind of idea in his head, and he starts talking to people in the field of psychopathic research, and he comes to find out that they all truly believe that, that's a valid hypothesis that he has. And so he kind of starts going down that road, and what he finds out is that it's true, and there have been studies. The difficulty about these studies is that, these are people who, whereas if it's a prison, someone in prison who's incarcerated for their life, they know they're never getting out because they've done horrible things, first of all, but they've been identified as having no remorse, no capability of guilt. They're never getting out. They're interested in themselves, and so they're happy to talk to these researchers and fill out these checklists because it's all about them.
Sure.
They get to regale them with what they think is their kind of life's work, which is a very strange way to think about it.
Yeah.
But that is how these people operate. It's hypothesized that that's how they operate. So they're more than willing to talk about it, but people in corporate America who are quote unquote successful, their willingness to come forth with this information is limited. So their ability to do actual quality research designs with this kind of population sample is compromised. But they have done some, and so that's kind of how I got into it and how this world is kind of working at this point.
Okay.
And so it's been taken, and there's been other articles in the New Yorker and some business magazines that have taken this idea and talked about it, and I've even read some things that there's, you know, human resources departments are reading this stuff now as they're considering these guys, which is really interesting.
Okay. Boy, they really need to do this with police departments, don't you think, Gus?
Well, like any type of group, any type of bureaucratic system, yes. I think that it's an important test, so.
Yeah. and that gets into what we talked about at the beginning, the idea of a sociopathic versus psychopathic, where are they doing it because this behavior makes them feel good about themselves and they enjoy it, or are they doing it because it's the culture around them that makes it okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I think from a bureaucratic standpoint, that's a really important distinction.
Okay, well, I'm going to open the phone lines here, 217-359-5483, if you have any questions for Kevin. And, you know, it's interesting, my next question. Oh, here we go. Wow. Alrighty. Alright. Get the right phone line here. Hello, WFT. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Dave. It's Bill.
Hi, Bill. How you feeling?
I'm not feeling too bad.
Okay.
But I didn't want to come in and shed flu viruses all over the place.
Well, I appreciate that. So, now, you know, I credited you at the beginning of the show is that, you know, this kind of happened when Kevin was on last time. This has been a kind of a interesting subject matter for you. So, what do you think so far of what Kevin's had to say?
Well, I think he's described things as I have seen them described and as I think they are. There are differences between sociopaths and psychopaths. I think that the sociopathy side might be a little bit is learned,
mm-hmm.
and that the psychopath side is an evolutionary function. Okay, at one time it was great to have people who had very limited feelings to fight saber-toothed tigers with bare hands or possibly spears and arrows.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is not very appropriate at this time to have such people who, by the way, do have great advantage even in civilized society in mm-hmm. reaching positions of power, who now have guns and nuclear weapons.
Okay.
Besides the economic weapons that they have that they can use on people for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Bill. How are you? Thanks for calling in. So when he says he's exactly correct. There's actually been brain research and fMRI, you know, functional magnetic resonance imaging studies where they've studied the brains of these guys, those being psychopaths, purported psychopaths, and they actually have pretty consistently found in a few of these studies that they have smaller amygdalas in the brain. By a pretty substantial size. And so the amygdala is part of the limbic system in the brain. It regulates emotion, aggression. It also plays some role in memory. But it also, has some control over the functions to fear response, and arousal and things like that. So he's right that there is
Is not just a behavioral trait that's somehow learned growing up, let's say, you know, either influenced by the parents or peers. There's actually an organic basis to this. This is what fascinates me.
Correct. Yep. That is the going hypothesis, and you can look them up. There's you know, peer-reviewed journal articles out there with mm-hmm. fMRI studies on this.
So. Okay. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, so what I want to bring up is you do have to remember we have this does raise the nurture versus nature question, and that because someone has a genetic predisposition, let's say, doesn't mean that they are totally locked into that.
Okay.
And part of something, too, which is also a concern for me as well as a hope for me, is that the plasticity of human brains, where the great hope of it is that through education programs and so on and so forth, that we can rid ourselves, or at least if not eliminate, but greatly lessen psychopathy, you know, and also at the same time it would help with, you know, sociopaths, you know, learn not to be that way. And number two, earlier this week, Dave brought up Edward Bernays.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And the entire marketing, advertising, public relations, propaganda industry what effect that might have had on people over the decades. I mean, I seriously wonder if people think a lot differently than perhaps they did
100 years ago.
Since their channels of thinking keep going down certain roads, one of which is many fear. You know, since World War II, I mean, I don't remember in the past, or you know, where people are becoming somewhat a little, you know, somewhat at least, you know, hardwired towards those ways through this onslaught of propaganda and bad information.
That's a fascinating question, Bill. So, Bill, anyway, okay, thank you for calling in on that. And if there's any other callers that want to call in, please feel free, 217-359-5483. Thanks, Bill.
All righty.
Okay. That is a fascinating question, Kevin. He was talking about, you know, the godfathers of modern public relations and propaganda in the United States, Edward Bernays, who was Sigmund Freud's, I guess, nephew or something.
I'll have to go on that one.
But where he's saying they originally developed their techniques, first of all, to sell the world, First World War, the American people, when Britain entered the war, well, basically in early 1916, 70-80% of the people were opposed to entering World War One, and within a year's time, it was, almost flipped completely around. It was 70-80% who supported it. Mm-hmm. And within that year, there's documented, proof, you know, about how the Wilson administration hired these pioneers in public relations propaganda to do a huge public relations campaign through the medium at the time, silent film, newsreels, the movie industry, newspapers, magazines, various, talks by so-called experts. Well, this sounds familiar today, doesn't it? In a lot of ways, to basically influence people. And now so they basically, from what I know about it is that the core of their techniques was to prey on people's emotions, in particular fear, envy, things like this. So the darker side of the emotions. Now, Bill's saying is he's wondering if now 100 years later, how the advertising industry has just exploded, and so has, in my opinion, propaganda through the media, how this maybe has, as he called it, hardwired people, maybe made them, because of these influences of constantly going to their dark emotions, have actually encouraged them and brought them to the surface in a large segment of the population. So what do you think about that, Gus, Kevin?
You can actually trace it back to the Spanish-American War, actually, when they, when the sinking of the ship, I forgot which one it was.
Oh, the Maine?
Yeah, the Maine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what they did was that nobody was going about the whole going to Cuba and taking the colony and stuff. But once they published those stories and they put so much detail about the emotional depth and the blood and the bodies and the children that were on the ship and all this other stuff. I mean, yeah, this stuff is calculated. And you go forward today with things like American Sniper. And I bet you, like I said, we look up those military records of enlistment over the next couple of years, a few years down the line from now, you're going to see enlistment skyrocket just like it did after 9/11. Mm-hmm. I mean, so you see this type of propaganda being pumped and it's assisting in imperialism in the way they're doing these things.
Yeah, Kevin?
Yeah, I just a couple of more recent examples of, the government preying on the fear of people that I think of is that the constant invoking of 9/11 is one that's pretty obvious. Dick Cheney was back on, not to bring his name up, but he was back on TV not too long ago, and that's his mantra, but one that really sticks out in my mind from recent years is yellow cake uranium.
Oh, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yeah.
That they were certain it was there, and that's why we were going into Iraq. And
Mushroom
clouds, yeah. And
where are those weapons of mass destruction?
The guy was hiding in a hole underneath the ground with none of them, right?
Yeah.
We all know. And what did they say? Oops, we made a calculated mistake based on the intelligence we had at the time, which we also know and pretty certain was manufactured. So, they certainly try to propagate their agenda, in my opinion.
Okay.
There are some who try to propagate their agenda based on fear responses in people.
Okay. We're going to take a quick music break. We're going to be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on the supported community radio station WFT in Champaign. Stay tuned.
As we come marching in the
Ed Miller kept the Senior Citizen Center for a long time up there in Seattle, Washington. Jack had spent most of his life in the forest as a logger or timber beast, they called him in those days, because you were treated like an animal. There were no bunkhouses. He recalled sleeping on the ground with his fellow workers with their wet clothes from the rainforest piled in a heap next to the fire, hoping that they would be dry by the time to go to work the next day. He spoke many different languages in the forest, and they could hardly talk to each other. It was just like Lawrence. He said most of them had never been to school. Most of them couldn't read or write. Jack Miller could remember the Verona. There was a shingle weaver strike up at Everett, Washington, called the Everett Massacre. It's another one of those that didn't make it into the history books. The Wobblies, they chartered a steam launch called the Verona, and they had it sailed up there to Everett, bringing strike relief, and as the boat sailed into the pier, Sheriff McRae had ringed the whole pier with armed deputies. He just deputized every drunk in every bar in town and put a rifle in their hand. Well, they surrounded the boat, and when they lowered the gangplank, Sheriff McRae walked to the end of it and said, "Who are your leaders here?" And they shouted back with one voice, "We are all leaders here." Well, that scared the tar out of the law, you know.
Okay, that was Utah Phillips, and that song was "Why Come." And it's Direct Action. So we got some public service announcements here. Be proud, birth parents' rights on ultimate demand, and empowering child take back mission and call in radio program every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WRFU 104.5. Did DCFS workers take away your kids or those of others? Give you false hope? Deny the return home? Then seek to end your parenting? For this and other topics, if you want to join us on the air with your related thoughts and experience, feel free to call the number above, 217-344-2536. So anyway, let you know that, public service announcements, please join us, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, mayoral candidate, Jesus Chuy Garcia, and many others to build momentum for, this woman named Susan who's running for, alderman seat in the 10th ward in Chicago. That's happening, Thursday, April 2nd at 6:30. At the United Steelworkers headquarters, it's at 11731 Avenue O in Chicago. And if you have any questions, you can call 773-902-7602. That's 773-902-7602. And tune in this Sunday and every Sunday for Labor's Worldview TV from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 and live at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. And last but not least, school board candidates will discuss will discuss education and labor issues that impact Champaign Federation of Teachers and the Champaign IEA support staff members and the public as well on a panel moderated by veteran teacher and former Champaign Federation teacher Vice President Greg Stock. And this will be followed by a brief member question and answer session. Board candidates in attendance will include Kathy Shannon, Kathy Richards, Jonathan Westfield, Christopher Kloppel, Lisa Young, and Azar Cobbs, Karis Lee, and Amy Armstrong. So please contact Champaign Federation of Teachers Union Steward Caleb Curtis at cdcurtis@gmail.com. And anyway, that's going to be coming up here March 31st, 2015. And it begins at 5 p.m., runs till about 7, and on-site child care is available. And that is at the International Brotherhood of Electricians Local 601, 3301 Boardwalk Drive in Champaign, and it's off of North Prospect, which is, I believe that's on Olympia Drive, past the Carmike Theater. So you may want to call for some more specific directions because it's a little difficult to find. So again, I'm sorry, the email cdcurtis@gmail.com, and we'll give you more updates on that as the time approaches here. So anyway,
I actually have a brief update on that.
Oh, David, yes, please.
If you don't mind.
Sure.
Since they came out with that information, they have confirmed Jamar Brown will also be there, who is current school board. Current school board member. So all nine candidates are going to be present at the forum, which is great. People can hear what everyone has to say and make their own informed decisions.
Okay, and he's the only incumbent. Is that correct?
Karis Lee is an incumbent.
Oh, Karis Lee is an incumbent, mm-hmm, too. Okay. Mm-hmm. Gus, did you happen to attend that school board candidate forum last Sunday?
Yeah,
I wasn't able to make it.
Yeah, I was there. It went really well. Both of the incumbents were there, and they answered a lot of great questions. They were very clear and concise in terms of what people are looking forward to in terms of this referendum.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very much so excited to see where this is going, because mm-hmm. this seems that this really has the community up a lot. It's a lot more aggressive, more aggressive than I thought it would be, because the time is coming closer. So it was well attended too.
Okay, good. Because you know, in the past, I have to admit, I've done the same thing as a lot of people have, is that you go to school board for school board, and it's like, I don't know any of these people. Let me see. I'll go random check system, or I'll go by alphabetical, you know, whatever. And it's horrible, because you shouldn't vote that way. And because, you know, I'll tell you about, when was it, 15 years or so ago, there was a concerted campaign by some right-wing interests that actually got were able to take 3 seats on the Champaign School Board. And it was really some pretty tense times. It was a local real estate developer, a local businessman, and a former, believe it or not, a former school administrator, very, very right-wing individuals, and they were really pushing a right-wing agenda. They were trying to destroy the unions in the public schools, and the unions, to their credit, boy, they fought back, and they fought back hard, and they made, in the end, they made fools of these people, and they didn't get reelected. But, you know, it was an interesting, because I had, prior to that, when the 3 of those got elected, I'd never seen school board candidates put up half a dozen billboards around town. I mean, that's just not something that's usually done. Yeah, that's a lot of money, you know.
I mean, it's really historic, too, because, you know, from the people I know that grew up here, for what the North End Men's Breakfast Club did by bringing that forum to Douglas Center, that the candidates usually don't come out to that part of the community, the African American working class and poor part of North End. Mm-hmm. So it was very great to see them there and to actually engage the community in so many different ways. So yeah, big ups to the North End Men's Breakfast Club that put that event on, sponsored it. It was excellent. Patricia Avery and Imani Bazell did a great job moderating it. So
okay.
Yeah,
and it makes it more relevant, I think. Forums like that, so that's very important here. So, okay, to continue on our subject here at hand about psychopathic behavior in people in positions of power, you know, I can see how it'd be pretty easy to do tests on prisoners, you know, since they're kind of a captive audience and they probably don't have much anything else to do.
Right.
How did they ever conduct any studies on politicians or people in the corporate world?
So Hare was able to do a study, and how he did this, I don't think he got direct access to them, but he must have gotten maybe the, you know, HR personality profiles, and they did some digging around on these people. They were able to fill out the psychopath checklist on 203 corporate professionals. And so prior to this study, the estimated incidence of psychopathy in the general population is around 1%, slightly 1% are the estimates. You'll see that fluctuate, but hovers around that 1% number. What they found when they gave the PCL, then these 203 corporate professionals, they found, about 3.9% of them had a score of 30 or higher, which is considered extremely high on this psychopathy rating scale. Mm-hmm. And so that suggested about a 4 to 5 times higher prevalent rate than the population at large. And to give you an idea, the prison population of psychopathic individuals has estimated from research to be about 15% to 23%.
Okay.
So there's a lot of them in prisons, and that's why they're there, because mm-hmm. they are constantly engaging in criminal behaviors. So I don't know exactly how they got access to them, mm-hmm. but I know the study's out there. You know, one of the major criticisms of that study too is that it wasn't necessarily a representative sample. They got the access to the profiles they could. And you know, one of the big criticisms of the psychopath checklist is that it, you know, like a lot of psychology, it's kind of a soft science area a little bit, where you are another person is rating kind of intangible personality characteristics of another person. It's not like they're putting them under an fMRI and saying, yep, there it is. There's mm-hmm. the reduced amygdala. There's the prefrontal cortex issues. We know this guy has this problem. Or you can put someone under a scan and say, you know, hey, there's a tumor. We can diagnose this immediately. So it's kind of a third-party rating system. So there's some criticisms of that there. But I think there's also there's some weight to what they're doing here, mm-hmm. too. And so can we go into an example of one of these guys? So in Ronson's book, you know, there's a couple of different people that he profiles and actually meets. He actually meets Bob Hare and goes through like a week-long training on how to give the piece, the psychopath checklist. And so he takes this and he starts to seek out some people. And one of them is a CEO. He goes to the company Sunbeam. And he goes down to a closed down plant in Mississippi. And it used to employ hundreds of people. And it's, you know, the same situation you see all over America, right? There used to be kind of these industrial jobs and it's decayed from the inside out once they moved them overseas. And so this is that same picture. And so there's five employees left in this giant sprawling complex, right? And so one of the guys has been there forever. And so they're all sitting there talking and they start telling Ronson about the different CEOs they've had and how one was crazier than the next. Well, I shouldn't use the word crazy. Okay. One was just more terrifying than the next one. Mm-hmm. And so they start going down the list of these guys. And so the first one they talk about was this guy, Robert Buckley. And he was fired in 1986 by the shareholders. And they said, basically, this guy had five jets. He had a Rolls Royce. He used to spend tens of thousands of dollars on ice sculptures. Oh. You know, he used company money and to give his son $1 million to buy an apartment. He would spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on wine. And, you know, the kicker is he had this security guy who would follow him around with a semi-automatic machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was so disliked. They're
this
like,
guy should be in jail.
Right. You know, well, it gets worse. So then
okay,
they're
it gets
like,
worse. Okay.
They're like, well, then there's this next guy. The next guy, his name's Paul Kazarian. And so they are like, you know, this guy used to throw pints of orange juice in people's faces at meetings. When executives weren't at meetings and there are empty chairs, he would shoot at their empty chairs with BB guns. And, you know, these are things that these guys had witnessed, right? And then they go, well, what about Dunlop? And then there's this silence. And apparently he was the truly scary one. And he's the one that Ronson ends up meeting with and doing the psychopath checklist with.
Okay.
And so they're talking to him about this. And so this guy, Al Dunlop, who is the CEO of Sunbeam, which, you know, makes toasters and small appliances, he kind of made his career working for the Scott Tissue Company, and he was known for closing everything down, basically shipping overseas, saving money, saving himself money, mm-hmm. making money for himself and not thinking about the average worker, right? So this guy's actually been featured in an article in a magazine called a publication called Fast Company on psychopathic CEOs. Again, these articles are out there. And so they start going through some of the information on this guy. And then he meets with him and he does the psychopath checklist on him. And of course he ends up scoring very high. And so some of the things that they talk about in this guy, you know, he actually gets, the author gets some access to some divorce papers from his original divorce.
Cool.
And he had threatened his knife with a wife or his wife with a knife. With a knife. His wife reported in the divorce proceedings, he used to frequently comment on what human flesh tasted like. He took great joy in firing people in very creative ways. So he was hired by Sunbeam in 96, and within the first year, this guy fires half the 12,000-person workforce for Sunbeam. He closes plants in Mississippi, Tennessee, Arkansas, Louisiana, and the list kind of goes on. By 98, he's invested less than 2 years, 20 months later, he's being investigated by the Security and Exchange Commission for $60 million in fraud. He demands from Sunbeam a severance package of $100 million. He's been with the company for 20 months. So in 2002, he finally settles for paying $18.5 million across various lawsuits that filed against him by the SEC. And he basically has to agree that he's never going to serve as the director of a public company again. So one of the employees that he's talking about there, you know, they went back and did some digging on this guy and they went back to his high school and he reported that he was a boxer. He used to enjoy beating people up is what he said. One person that knew him reported that he used to throw darts at his sister's dolls when he was a little child. This guy never served any time in prison. So Ronson goes and visits him at what is now his huge mansion. And the first thing he notices is that the place is literally covered in stone carvings of predatory animals. Panthers, tigers, sharks, they're uh-huh. everywhere. And so this guy apparently really admires the predatory, the apex predator.
Mm-hmm.
His house is filled with giant paintings of himself. he has, yeah, you know, they're shameless self-promoters, and that's that.
I can see naked women, but yourself, I mean, please.
He describes it as life-sized, yeah. You know, oil paintings of himself.
Wow.
He even has giant paintings of his prized German Shepherd dogs, but none of his children. So, you know, he goes through this guy, and the guy, of course, scores very high on this checklist, and, you know, when he's interviewed by Ronson, and Ronson asks him about Sunbeam and his time at Sunbeam, and this is the guy's quote. The quote is, quote, "Sunbeam didn't work. Sunbeam's a footnote in my career. It wasn't the biggest corporation. It had products that were a bit fickle. Appliances. I don't get too disturbed about it. In the scheme of things, it's inconsequential." So you start to paint a picture here of someone who would make these decisions, you know, that would affect many thousands of people. And doesn't bat an eye over it.
Yeah.
And clearly was in it for himself and the money. And so these are the types of people that he starts interviewing and encountering.
Well, gee, I understand now what's going on now with this, blitzkrieg of neoliberal capitalism. I mean, obviously, there's a bunch of these guys worldwide, and especially in the United States, that are controlling, the economy and government, you know. I know it's a huge generalized statement, but, man, this is – when you talk about this guy in the – a microcosm, yep. This guy, it just, you know, I can't help but think in the broad sense, the macro sense, you know, here.
So, Chainsaw Al was his nickname.
Yeah.
Chainsaw Al.
You can look it up.
Listen to the title of his book. If you want to hear about narcissism.
Yes.
Mean Business, How I Save Bad Companies and How I Make Good Companies Great. I mean, this guy was something else, like just reading his story. And yeah, he's notorious for being, yeah, what like Kevin was saying, just this, he's the prototype, not necessarily psychopath, but just in terms of before this book came out, but he was always known as this guy, like the corporate downsizer, the one that went in and cleaned house and did all these things. So these stories coming to light now is really starting to see, like, we wonder, like Dave said, what is really going on behind closed doors with these capitalists?
Mm-hmm.
You know, cause it's probably more common than we think.
Yeah. You know, I remember a story about, this is back in the 90s, some CEO of, actually, I think he was a venture capitalist named Alan Dershowitz out in, I think, the West Coast, where he actually was criticized. Of course, he went in and bought up different lumber companies and stuff, and immediately, you know, laid off most of the workers, and then would basically, his policies then would just counteract all these good forestry management things in the past, and would just clear cut, I mean, hundreds and thousands of acres. And basically his response to it was, "I hate forests anyway. What good are they unless you can make money off the lumber, you know?" And I mean, this guy not only destroyed, and you could see this, how this would extend. I mean, polluting the local water supply, who cares?
Right.
Go to war and kill a million people so we could grab their resources, the natural resources, and enslave their cheap labor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like great for my bottom line. I mean, you start to see this pattern.
What we see happening is, and I think Kevin touched on this greatly, is that this is not necessarily about me providing money. For some of them, it's not about providing money or making my company better or taking advantage of some other people. It's like an actual internal drive.
Yeah.
It's about winning.
That they get off on. Just doing these types of things, like it fuels them to do these things to people. It's not even beyond the money part anymore. The material part is gone, like most capitalists. It's an internal drive now to satisfy a personal desire that they have.
And you're right. And one of the 20 marks on the psychopath checklist is conning and manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
They enjoy the manipulation of others.
So you're saying one of the another characteristic of these kind of people is they tend to be very charming and charismatic.
Absolutely.
Too.
That's actually one of the hallmark characteristics, is a superficial charm. Grandiose sense of self-worth, proneness to boredom, pathological lying, manipulation, lack of guilt.
Yeah, they said Ted Bundy, like, he could walk in a room and literally just charm anyone in the room and not think twice about it.
Yeah, he's one of the most famous psychopaths out there. And a lot of people don't know that he escaped twice.
Really?
Absolutely. You know, the famous story of him when he went down to Florida and did the horrendous crime at the sorority. sorority home in, in Florida. That was, he was on a lam. He was escaped.
Mm-hmm. Whoa.
He jumped from a second story courthouse window or a third story courthouse window.
Man, oh man. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for coming to World Labor Hour. This has been, very fascinating and enlightening, and it explains a lot of things, I think, you know, and I think this is why things like this are important, because, you know, to really get an understanding of what's going on out there, sometimes, you have to look at, other disciplines and, you know, research that might not be directly related. So, thanks again, Kevin, and, keep up the good work.
Thanks,
and, again, sometime we'll have to have you back in the future, whether it's, for local, teacher union stuff, or, maybe you might think of another very fascinating topic like this one today. So.
Sounds great.
Okay, you've been listening to World Labor Hour on the Supporting Community Radio Station, WFT, in Champaign, Illinois. Until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.